Need a reason to smile? Comfort Dental has you covered with new patient exams, including x-rays, for just $19. That's right, only $19 to get started on a healthier, brighter smile. With convenient locations, flexible hours, including evenings and Saturdays, and a team that truly cares, Comfort Dental makes dental care easy and affordable. No gimmicks, no stress, just quality care when you need it. Get comfortable with Comfort Dental. Call or visit ComfortDental.com today.
The Magic Book Club with Benson's for Beds.
Hello and welcome to the Magic Book Club podcast. Tom Price here, and welcome to a brand new year of books. In times like this, books, well, they really are a tonic, and I think they're going to be a massive part of what gets us through this. I mean, sure, vaccines are good, but books really are better. Well, lucky for us, they're not better, by the way. Let me just retract that straight away. Well, lucky for us, we're kicking off the year with an incredible debut from Robert Jones Jr. And as a little fix for the January blues, we've got a mind coach joining us. So get in touch with your inner chimp, because Don McPherson is going to be here later on to give us some secrets to get through this year. So pour yourself a cuppa, or get your running shoes on, or let the dog off the lead and get walking, and we'll find out just what there is to know about some of the best books to kick off the year with. Now, the first book is fantastic. I am so thrilled to welcome this writer to the show. The Guardian called it an outstanding debut. USA Today describes it as a magically written debut. We've got the brilliant, brilliant man behind this, Robert Jones Jr., with us now, all the way from across the pond. Robert, hello, can you hear me?
Yes, thank you so much for having me.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you for writing this book. The Prophets is, it's, do you know what? I started reading this book, Robert, on the stroke of midnight on New Year's Day. So this is very much the first book of 2021. And you've set all my other books a frighteningly high bar. I loved it.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely brilliant. How does it feel to first of all, to have your debut book out there in the world, finally?
Surreal. It doesn't feel real to me. It's something I've been working on this book for the better part of 14 years.
Oh, wow.
And to finally have it out in the world for other people to read and think about and comment on is overwhelming. And I still haven't fully internalized the idea that it's happening. So I'm doing these interviews like with wonderful people such as yourself, and I'm doing a book tour, and it still feels like there's another Robert that's doing that, and then there's the Robert that's me that's like, I can't believe this is happening.
Was it always your dream to get to become a published author? Was that always what you wanted to do?
Yes, from childhood, really. My father bought me my first comic book when I was 4 years old, and I used to start when I was about six. I started rewriting them, including myself in them, and realized that I had a knack for it, and but never really thought that it could be a profession, because, you know, I didn't know any writers. I saw people who did labor and went to work every day for 9-to-5 sort of jobs, but I never knew that people could actually do writing as work until I was maybe a teenager, almost an adult. But yes, it is something that I was always in my heart to do. I just didn't realize I had permission to do it.
It's really interesting you should say that. How did you get yourself into a world where you were with people who were determined and knew that it would happen for them, and you could pick up on that and make it happen for you as well? How did you force yourself into that world?
Really, it started with realizing that, hey, wait a minute. The books that I'm reading are written by people who treat this as a profession, as an art. How can I get into know people like this? And that came along with school. Once I decided that writing was the thing that I wanted to do, despite objections from family or people who thought that writing was perhaps a hobby, but nothing that you could use as to take care of yourself. I went to school and I met other writers. And social media has also been helpful with that of late, introducing myself to other writers, successfully published writers, and forming a community with them. But it really started in school. It was the first time that I ever met other people who wrote and wanted to become published writers.
Do you still have to detach that voice that says, you know, this is the family voice? I think a lot of people have this, that if they have a background and a family that assume writing and creativity in the arts isn't for our family, that's not what we end up doing. Do you have to detach that voice? Does it still exist with you?
Yes. I think it's just from the upbringing that there's this idea that the arts is frivolous.
Yes.
That it's something that you do as a side thing, but you're really, first of all, you're a man, so you should be doing something manly, like, I don't know, construction or something to that effect. But I always gravitated toward the arts and writing in particular. It wasn't until I think my mother saw an interview with me on a local radio station here that she believed, oh my goodness, he's really doing this. This is really what he should have been doing the whole time. And that family voice is gone. My family is extremely proud of me, but there's this inner critic, my own inner opponent that still says, are you worthy of this? Is this what you're supposed to be doing? Shouldn't you be doing something that's more laborious than this?
You
So
should
I still have that a little bit.
take that inner critic to a building site once a year. Just make work there for a day and go, right, inner critic, are you happy now? Look how badly I've done that wall. Right.
I think you're right.
So this story you've taken on, arguably it's the most important American story. And before we get into that, tell us more about you. Tell us about your story, Robert Jones Jr. Where did you grow up? Where are you from? What is your background? Give us a brief outline of that.
I was born and raised in New York City in the United States. I lived in Brooklyn for most of my life. Grew up in a section of Brooklyn called right on the border of two neighborhoods called Bensonhurst and Gravesend, where I grew up. I grew up during the 70s and 80s in that neighborhood. There was a lot of racial tension. I have a really good story about that racial tension too. Often when we were let out of school, the neighborhood children would we were black, and we lived in a housing project that was sort of surrounded by Italian and Irish immigrants. And every day after school, they would chase us home with bottles and bats and chains back into our neighborhood. And there was one time where we were being chased home, and a librarian opened the library door, pulled me in. I couldn't be more than maybe 9 or 10 years old, locked the door, and said, you're going to stay here until it's safe for you to go home. And she sat with me, and she read to me, and she let me read books and just go around the library. And just from that moment on, librarians became superheroes to me, and just solidified my love of reading and my love of writing. And librarians are intimately attached to my story in terms of the writer Robert.
I love that. Look what you did, racists. You chased me into a library. You empowered me. You armed me with knowledge. You armed me with a pen. It's beautiful.
In a literal sense.
Gosh, were you scared? Was it a scary time to grow up with that kind of background?
Yeah, it was incredibly scary. I don't know if you've ever heard this story. I think it took place in 1989 of a young gentleman named Yusef Hawkins, who was killed here in Brooklyn, and it made like national news and maybe even international news. I was only two blocks away when he was murdered. And so, yes, it was a very daunting and haunting and scary time to live in that section of Brooklyn, or maybe in all of New York City, to be honest.
Yeah. And you'd think that when writing, or you could assume that when writing, you escape to, I don't know, a more comfortable time, a better time, a time to try and get comfort from it. And you very much haven't. Tell us where The Prophets is set and what this story is.
The Prophets is the story of Samuel and Isaiah, two enslaved young men on a plantation in Antebellum, Mississippi, here in the United States. And it's about their love, how that love between the two of them, and it's a romantic love, affects everyone around them, whether enslaver or fellow enslaved, and how it transforms that plantation and leads that plantation down the path that it takes. It is a daunting period to write about because it is, slavery and violence are synonyms. It was a very violent period of American history. So it's really difficult to write about those times. So what I wanted to do was imbue it with a sense of humanity, let the reader understand these individuals not as enslaved people, but as people, and how, yes, they faced a untold cruelty, unspeakable violence, but they also loved, they also danced, they also experienced joy.
Yeah. And it's a story that, I think you allude to this, it's a story, it must have happened. It must have. I know it's fictional, but it you know, the actual physical story about these men, but it must have happened. And why has this story never been told before? I feel like this is, you've opened a door into this world, which, I you know, I'm familiar. Well, as kids, we learn about the boats going from Africa to America hundreds of years ago, and that can so easily become background music, and it can so easily almost become desensitized to it, as horrific as it clearly is. But by taking this approach to this story, you've relit those embers, and it's incredible what you've done.
Well, I really was answering a call from Toni Morrison, who said, if you cannot find the book you wish to read, you must write it. Because as an undergraduate student, I was an Africana studies minor. Creative writing was my major. And I read all of these wonderful works by wonderful Black authors, whether it was slave narratives or books on race theory and politics and so on. And something was just quite confounding to me, which was, there was no mention of Black queer characters prior to the Harlem Renaissance of the 1920s. Mm. And I thought, well, where are the queer people in this community? Did they just pop up out of nowhere in 1929 and say, hello, here we are? But no. So I began to research to determine if I could discover Black queer people prior to then. And what I found was few and far between. I found in a book called Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl by Harriet Jacobs, which is a slave narrative. She talks about how a slave master raped a male slave. And then in Toni Morrison's own Beloved, I found there's a section where one of her characters, Paul D, is sexually assaulted by an overseer. And I thought, okay, but what about love? And from that question, The Prophets was born.
Yeah. Yeah, it's fantastic. I mean, it's not just, you know, it's not just set during the antebellum time, during the actual, it's called Empty, isn't it? This
yes.
It's Empty. Ugh.
Yes.
But also there's several chapters set before there, back in Africa. And those are fascinating as well, because that looks at how same-sex relationships were approached and were looked at then as well.
Yeah, what was incredibly fascinating to me during my period of research for this novel was discovering that prior to European colonialism, prior to Christian missionaries coming to the continent, many African societies treated what we now call queerness as just a normal part of life. Mm. There was not even terms to distinguish heterosexuality from homosexuality or bisexuality. All of it was just love and sex. Esther Arma, who is a profound artist and activist, she's from Ghana, and she talks about how her grandparents, if you said to them, what is a homosexual, they would say, I don't know. But if you describe to them what you meant, they would go, oh, love. Yes, of course. Because their sort of cultural metaphor was love and sex were like the land. It had no boundaries. And discovering that, in contrast to what I was raised to believe here in a Western country, was just mind-blowing. Mm. And I wanted to sort of share that discovery with the reader, and in particular, people in Black communities who have been taught to believe that queerness is a part of sort of like a trauma we learned as a result of being enslaved. And that it is something that is ungodly because we have been programmed to be Christians. Mm-hmm. I wanted to explain and show them that, no, that is actually not true, that Blackness and queerness are indeed compatible. And it is, in fact, our sort of Christian indoctrination and European colonialism that taught us that is not true.
Yes. So that's interesting. So it's become a reaction to Black history to think that So that there, just to clarify, there was this assumption that queerness was a reaction to slavery, was people doing what they had to do, almost like some, in prison or something.
It was almost like we were all on the continent of Africa heterosexual, but then when we were enslaved, we were traumatized and shown untold brutality, and that forced us to become something degraded like homosexuals. That this is the result of a trauma, not something that's natural to our human nature.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. And do you feel the trauma? Obviously, there's so many levels of it here. The thing that kept striking me, Robert, when I was reading this, was just how long this went on for. Reading this book and thinking, you know, so many atrocities in human history happen over 5 or 10 or 15 years. This went on for such a long time, and that is something which I really took away from this book, and it really affected me.
The weight of those centuries is so heavy. Yeah. To think that in Brazil it went on even longer than in the United States, that actually blows my mind when I think about it. But
is that right? I didn't know that.
Brazil. In Brazil, Brazil has the largest population of black people outside of Nigeria. And their slavery ended way after the United States. Like they went on for at least another 20 to 50 years of slavery and brutality. In the United States, we always start with the year 1619 and say that is when the first slaves were brought to the continental United States. But that's actually not true. The Spanish actually brought slaves to Florida, what is now Florida, in the 1500s.
Right.
And then slavery technically ended in 1865, at least on the record, but it actually endured a lot longer and then transformed into something else, like what we now think of as the prison industrial complex. But yes, centuries and centuries of brutality that have stained the soil of this country. And we have yet to really reckon with what that means. Yeah. And as a result, still deal with the fallout, yes, and the transformation of anti-blackness in this country.
So how does this feed into your feelings now about things like Black Lives Matter, about moments that are happening in America today? You know, it's very easy to read this and say this is dead history. This is not dead history. This is happening now. There's still effects of this. The tales of this are still being felt. When you see, you know, images, which I never thought I'd see, the Confederate flag, you know, making it to the Capitol as it did the other day. How does this book help to give that context? How does it help us to tell that story?
What I learned in writing this book was that racism, or anti-blackness, as it were, is incredibly resilient. So it changes to fit whatever era and whatever the mores of the society it's in will accept. So in the 17th century, in the 18th century, there was, in the 19th century, there were overseers who whipped the slaves, and we don't have those anymore, but we have police officers who kill unarmed black people with impunity. And we no longer have cotton plantations where we're picking cotton, but we now have the prison industrial complex, which disproportionately locks up black people for the smallest, most trivial of offenses, and also locks up innocent black people. So in a way, things have not changed as much as we would like to think that they have. And Black Lives Matter is a reaction to that understanding that we are still being regarded as the Constitution once put it, 3/5 of a human being. We are not considered full humans, and we are being regarded by the other members of the society, by the institutions, by the government itself, as something less than human when we are utterly, utterly human. So when I read the prophets, I think, wow. We are still enduring what our ancestors endured. We're just calling it by different names, and it's taking place on a different landscape.
Yes. This is exactly it. These are the seeds of what we see today. And you read it in this book, and you know, and you see, so this is, we've talked about the the huge, the weighty themes around it, but that would make this book feel, if it would almost overburden the book, and yet the characters are so good, the moments are so good. Timothy is fascinating. Talk to us about the character of Timothy, the son of the plantation owner.
Secretly, Timothy is one of my favorite characters.
Yeah.
because Timothy represents for me someone who is wrestling with the ideas that he was raised to believe, his traditions, and what new information he was exposed to. So he is trying to become a better person, trying and failing. And that is the, from a writerly point of view, such an interesting complexity that you have this character who believes himself as good, who really thinks he's trying to be good, and he is still haunted and still trapped by the situation he was raised in, the situation he's raised in to be. And I find him utterly fascinating, that he too is wrestling with some of the same things that Samuel and Isaiah are wrestling with, in a way. And he's trying to be a better person and not achieving it in the ways that he would, even he himself would hope. And that's just a fascinating place to write from.
Yeah. And he's the only character who has, as close to it, has been to the future. By going north and by escaping the south and escaping that world, he's seen a vision of well, it's not there yet by any means, but he's seen a vision of the direction of travel. And he's as close to us as it's possible to get, and yet he's still completely broken.
And the only white character in that book that is looking at these black characters and saying, I think we're wrong. I think they might actually be just as human as us.
Yeah. It's a remarkable piece. It really is brilliant. And it is, you know, it's very important for listeners to not think that it's, that this will overwhelm them, that this is it's a depressing read, or that this is, oh, you know, it looks pretty serious and difficult. It's beautifully written. It's lyrical. It's poetic. You fall into this world. You don't leave it despondent. You may feel anger, and you will bear witness when you read this book, which is an important thing to do, but you will fundamentally enjoy it. And it's because of characters. It's because of moments like that, that, you know, the stories in it are absolutely magnificent. How do you detach yourself from it, Robert? How do you, you're writing about trauma here. What do you do? How do you look after yourself to put your pen down and feel okay after a day writing about this kind of thing?
It was extremely difficult, I tell you. There were moments where I got lost in it and felt the pain of it. And I realized that if I'm feeling the pain of it, the reader is going to feel the pain of it. So I am going to have to balance this with something beautiful. It's either going to have to be in the language. It's going to have to be in the love between these two characters. It's going to have to be in something, some reprieve the reader is going to need. So I tried to write as beautifully as I knew how. I tried to imbue as much hope into this book as I possibly could, so that when the reader finishes it, whatever they endured in reading it, and thank you so much for enduring that, that they left it with a renewed sense of humanity and a sense of hope. So that is how I got through it, and I'm hoping that is how the readers will also get through it.
All you have is love at the end of something like this. That's what it all boils down to, love. When you have those characters so well portrayed, you see it beaming off every page. And your love for writing it as well is very clear. Talking of love of writing, what's next for you, Robert? What are we going to be looking at next, please? What's on the horizon?
Before The Prophets was purchased by publishers to become a novel, I had started working on a second novel, which takes place in a little bit of a more contemporary setting. I'm writing in the 1980s, okay. In New York City. A landscape that's a bit more familiar to me. But I had to stop all of that because now I'm in the Prophets mode and I'm promoting the book, and I had to work on it with my agent and editor. And so once I'm outside of this mode where I'm promoting the book and thinking and talking about the Prophets, I will return to the second novel that I'm working on. And hopefully it will not take me 14 years to produce.
So you're going to go from the Prophets to the time of Prophet. That's what we're talking about here.
Indeed.
There you go.
Indeed. Fantastic. The Reagan era, as we know it in the United States.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Robert, this has been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. An absolute pleasure. I hope that I hope you're feeling a sense of hope at the moment. How do you feel when you look at the landscape of your country after the events of 2020? Now we see the silence of that man on Twitter. Do you have a renewed sense of hope?
You know, Toni Morrison once said that when we encounter situations like the ones we're in, the instinct is to despair. And she said that that is not the job of the artist. The job of the artist in these precise moments is to go to work. That we are to produce the things that give people hope, whether it's painting paintings or reciting poetry or writing books or dancing or producing music, whatever it is. This is the time that the artist is supposed to go to work, because we are the bearers of hope. We're supposed to not only make the society look at itself, but also to provide some sort of path out of the mire. I do feel a sense of hope, particularly when I look at the accomplishments of Black women in the political movement, such as Stacey Abrams, and what they were able to accomplish in terms of voter enfranchisement in the state of Georgia. When I look at the fact that the majority of the country rejected the current president and his sort of approach to governing that was divisive and hateful and just chaotic. So while I do see his supporters really showing a really dark side of humanity, I have to remember that the other half of the country showed something that was much more hopeful. And so I do have hope for the future, particularly because the younger people were really showed out and really committed to justice and right thinking. And so I don't want to despair. And I do think that there's hope for the country and perhaps for the entire world.
Yes. Good. No despair. Run for the libraries. That's what we must do. Run for the libraries.
Yes,
and
yes.
When we're there, Get Out, The Prophets by Robert Jones Jr. It's a wonderful novel.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. I was so scared to release this book into the world, so I'm so happy that people are connecting with it.
Yes, definitely. And it's important that we connect with it in the UK. That, you know, this sense that slavery is here in the UK, we've learnt to say that's not us, that wasn't us, that was America's problem. And I think that in Britain we need to recognize our part in that and how that still plays out today, in the same way that you were saying earlier, you know, the roots of the problems with race in America started with slavery, and we need to recognize the same things in this country. So it's an important book for this country as well.
Wow, amazing. It's funny, small little anecdote. My great uncle on my father's side traced our roots, and he was able to trace our ancestors back to enslavement in England, of all places. Yeah, so yeah, indeed.
So actually, so your ancestors were actually owned in England or by English slave owners?
In England, by English slave owners. They were called the Habershams. That was the name of the family that owned my family. And when they started to suspect that there was a tide turning in England where slavery was being abolished, and it didn't seem to happen in one fell swoop, it happened in stages, they petitioned the king for land in America, and he granted them some land in Savannah, Georgia, and they moved the entire family, including my family, here to the States. And one of those people, the eldest son named Robert, did not survive the transport. So His younger brother, the second oldest child, named his firstborn son Robert, and every firstborn son down to me is named Robert in that line of my family. And the land that the Habershams owned, there is a street, a very major street in Savannah, Georgia, that is called Habersham Street. It still bears their name.
How do you feel about that?
It is overwhelming to know it. To be connected to an actual history where I could look up at the sign and say, those people owned my family. This is the land where my family dwelled and toiled. This is the land where the first Robert could not make it and the second Robert was born. It's just overwhelming. But it also imbues me with a sense of pride that the second Robert lived so that I could live.
Yes,
it's just amazing.
It is, and now to see to see that name, the family name Robert on this book, it feels appropriate. Robert, thank you so much for joining us on the Magic Book Club podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been such a joy.
Need a reason to smile? Comfort Dental has you covered with new patient exams, including x-rays, for just $19. That's right, only $19 to get started on a healthier, brighter smile. With convenient locations, flexible hours, including evenings and Saturdays, and a team that truly cares, Comfort Dental makes dental care easy and affordable. No gimmicks, no stress, just quality care when you need it. Get comfortable with Comfort Dental. Call or visit comfortdental.com today.
So here we are then. It is lockdown number three, lockdown the third. And I think for everyone, it's becoming increasingly difficult not to catch a case of the winter blues or the post-Christmas blues, or of course the COVID blues, the news blues. But we can beat it. We can beat it, guys. Just one listen to this podcast could help. And we've got British mind coach Don McPherson with us now to give us secrets of mastering our monkey mind. This is a fascinating topic. I'm so pleased we've got the Don of the monkey mind on the line. Hello, Don.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
I'm all right, thank you. I'm very good. Thoroughly enjoying your book. Tell us a bit about it.
Well, actually, it's all been a rather bizarre trip. The first lockdown, I'm afraid, got rid of all of my excuses as to why I hadn't got time to write a book. I never thought I would. I never thought I could. I never really desired to. I think my dad would be shocked that I'd even read a book, never mind written one. In the end, some people had asked me over the years to write about the monkey mind. I wish I could claim credit for the concept, Tom, of the monkey mind, because it is brilliant. It helps people of all ages, from people as young as 8 who I've worked with up to old farts like me. And it's just a mechanism to help us understand self-talk. And I thought phrases like self-talk were a bit psychobabble, a bit tired. And I fell upon this description of the voice that we all have in our heads chattering away, advising us. That the Chinese Buddhists thought it resembled a restless monkey swinging from tree to tree, aimlessly chundering and chattering on about everything and commentating. And that resonated with me because my monkey, Mike, as he's called, was all over the place.
I am fascinated by several things. First of all, this idea that, well, you never thought you'd write a book. And I've just, reading the opening chapter, you talk about yourself, your manner of writing is so approachable, it's so down to earth, and it feels like, I mean, talking about voices in your head, and I know that's the base unit of all reading, but it does feel like someone's just sort of nestled up next to you and they're just having a chat. It's a very laid back approach, which I like, because sometimes this kind of book and this genre of book, and this doesn't fit into that sort of genre of book, that sort of self-help thing, can take on a rather patronizing, pompous, self-important tone, and you puncture that very effectively.
Well, I'm absolutely delighted to hear you say that. Checks in the post, Tom, because that, I mean, if more people say things like that after they've read the book, I will be genuinely delighted, because I didn't set out to do that. People have often said in the emails that I send to people, clients that I'm working with, that it's, I write as though I talk, which my wife would tell you is a bit dangerous if you're a curmudgeon, gobby northerner. But that's the way it worked out, I guess, is that the book is quite close to how I talk. I mean, obviously, it had to be edited and preceded, otherwise it would have been 750 pages. But yeah. I am really, really happy to hear you say that you like the, that it sounded like I was having a chat with you. It's just sort of come together, I guess, at the right time, where people, I've had more and more people coming to me, especially obviously with the lockdowns.
Yes, do monkeys love lockdowns?
That's what monkeys absolutely hate lockdowns, because they want to, the worst, one of the things that the monkeys really hate is when they feel a lack of control. The monkey mind wants to be in control of everything, wants answers immediately to problems, solutions. And that's its job, its main job. The main job of the monkey mind, Tom, is in neuroscience, is the conscious mind. I love simplicity. And if we go for this, we have one brain and two minds. And I think the easiest way to understand the monkey mind is that it's the conscious mind, the life's filter, the sat nav, trying to make sense of your life. When the hell's this lockdown going to finish? When are we ever going to get out of this? Will I have a job? The monkey is, I'm afraid, rubbish at being in the now, the famous here and now. Terrible. And so if the monkey's trapped in a house or relatively trapped or feels trapped, and some people are, aren't they, in their front rooms, I mean, students or you know, old grannies, stuck in a front room and maybe can't get out physically or mentally. And when people say, oh, this thing's the same for all of us, we're all in the same boat. Well, we might be in the same massive boat, but it's not the same for all of us. One common thread is that we all have these monkey minds saying, when the hell is this thing going to finish? What can I do about it? And it's very, very difficult to be in the now. It is the most difficult of all mental skills to teach and to learn, because these days it's really difficult to be in the now.
Very much so. No, it's incredibly hard. And you know, I read years ago The Chimp Paradox, which, fantastic book, really helped me hugely. But the thing that I found very challenging about that, this central premise of controlling the monkey, because it is, everything the monkey says has got an exclamation mark or a question mark at the end of it. Everything. There is no acceptance. And it's this idea of, on one page of that book, it says, this is how you do it. And it's like, no, there's more to it than that. I think that what I like about this book is it spends more time thinking about the tools. You know, that's so important.
But you see, Tom, these tools, again, I wish I could claim credit. I wish I could, you know, say I want copyright and all these tools, but that would be ridiculous. The only reason the tools exist is because I learned them from the people I was working with. Very quick story. Many years ago, I was working with a Formula One racing driver who was very successful. He was on pole position in Monaco. And it was Saturday night. We were having a bit of a chat. I was his mind coach. And he started whinging about, oh, I hope the weather's okay tomorrow. I hope the car doesn't break like last year when this failed, because he was on pole as well. It was all whinge. And I got on well with him. So I said, you know, why don't you just cheer up and think more positively? You're on pole position at Monaco. You get a good start. You disappear into the sunset. You know, see you later. No one can overtake. What's the problem? You know, think more positively. And he said, and I'll have to watch my gobby northerners coming up here. He said, I am...
Is there some effing and jeffing?
Yes, I am bleep sick of you psychos telling me that I need to be calm. I need to think more positively. When's someone going to show me how to do this? And you know, like in those cartoons, when someone draws a balloon on a head and you come up with this eureka, this idea. But it was a bit of a bollocking that he gave me. But I actually... It was a tipping point. It was a magic moment for me, because I thought I was doing a decent job. And it was a good relationship with him, but it was a gentle rollicking. But honestly, Tom, I thought, you know what, there's a lot, just like you said a few minutes ago, there's a lot more to this than just telling people that they need to do that. And the reason why self-help books sell, and I've read thousands of them, is that you get to the end of even a good self-help book and you go, yeah, okay, that was really interesting. Now I know what I'm making a mess of. But so many times you're left with the question, so what am I supposed to do about it? How do I actually fix this lack of confidence that I've got? How do I deal with my glossophobia, etc.? How do I deal with...
What's glossophobia?
Oh, that's a fear of speaking in public, is yes.
Yes. So well, let's stop dancing around it. Let's try and sort of nudge in a little bit closer. So what are a few of the sort of headlines from this book? And obviously, again, I don't want you to sell the family silver. People have got to go and read the book. But what are we looking at? What are we talking about? What are your favourites, if you like?
Well, I get, are you talking about the tools, specifically the tools?
Yeah, I think people will want to hear by this point. People will want to, you know, we've talked a lot about, you know, your approach to writing it and why you want to do it. And I think a lot of people recognise that and understand that anxiety at the moment is really hard.
Okay.
What can we do?
Right. Well, there is a bit of a sequence, but you won't have time for it. I'll give you the abridged version. So if we start with the first tool, which is your starter for 10, literally, then this is the most extraordinary one. It's a special technique that I sort of blended from techniques that go back thousands of years. I call it Zen breathing. And this is the feedback I've had of all the tools, Tom. This is the one that surprised me most. And I was surprised by this. Even a cardiac surgeon thought this was his favorite tool. You would think a cardiac surgeon would know how to breathe properly. Yes. But as we get older, probably from the age of roughly 7, the monkey mind start developing and then producing a lot of adrenaline. And yeah, there's an alarm going off all the time, and we think we're in a war. And stress comes into our lives, peer pressure, and we become what's called upside down breathers. We start breathing predominantly from our chests, and we don't know we're doing it. And we shut down the diaphragm, where the tummy, where the abs, if you like. And that's, you were born breathing properly with your tummy moving up and down and your diaphragm working, sending oxygenated blood around your body and keeping your brain cool, acting as a fan. That's how we were born, if you watch dogs, cats, animals breathing. But we humans, we quite quickly, quicker than ever now, with internet and the kids growing up so fast, we become upside down breathers. We do not breathe efficiently or effectively or correctly. And the Zen breathing is really amazed me how effective it is, because the first thing that goes belly up when anxiety comes a calling is your breath technique. And you don't even know that you've lost your correct breathing. And that actually is like pouring petrol on a fire, because if you're anxious and now you're not breathing properly, you're not getting proper oxygen in, then your body starts to react negatively to the anxiety. And that's when things can turn to custard quite quickly. So the first thing to do proactively or reactively is, if you're feeling anxious or you're going into an anxiety-provoking situation, is check your breathing. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so the first tool is the Zen breathing, which you've read it, and it is a special technique. Where I think people get it wrong on breath techniques, and this is only my opinion, but it is as a result of feedback from people that I've taught this technique to. The trick, Tom, is to make the out-breath longer than the in-breath and just simply slow your breath down. If you do those two things, there's a bit more to it, but if you do those two things when you're feeling a bit anxious, because the first thing that happens when you get anxious, besides losing your breath, is that you talk quicker, you move quicker, and that's when you start to feel a bit of panic. Then your heartbeat speeds up, your blood pressure goes up, you start getting hot, a bit sweaty, and so on and so on. It triggers a whole lot of physiological stuff that we don't find very pleasant. So the first tool is, sounds really... breathe properly. So Zen breathing is number one. Now, number two is the one that might be a bit more interesting, a bit more creative. And this came from the F1 guy who said, right, I want to know how to think more positively. Fed up with you just telling me how. Go away. Come back. Tell me how. And the how to think more positively is this. And anyone listening can try this. And it's really quite enlightening. So it's about having a better relationship with this voice in your head, the monkey. Better banter with the monkey. You don't have to give it a name, Tom. Well, they'll be fascinated to know what your creative mind comes up with.
I think narcissistic lunatic in my head, I'm going to call it Trump. That works for me.
Well, that's the first monkey that's been called Trump. But anyway, that's good enough. Okay, but the tool to be more how to think more positively, how to be more positive, how to check your self-talk is to start tuning in, to listen to your own monkey. What percentage is negative? Just in a curious way, not in an obsessed way, just listen a little bit more in a childlike way to what your Trump is saying. Now, don't be alarmed if what you hear is predominantly negative, because the brain's factory settings, so to speak, are set to negative, because the job of the brain is to keep you safe. So we all should attempt to think more positively anyway, because, as I said, the brain setting is set to negative. If you start to tune in to what your Trump is saying and you think, well, that's unnecessarily negative, I'm not that bad at that. And is it really that bad? Is there nothing I can do about it? Am I really in that much trouble? Am I really going to lose my job? Or is that just Trump going off and having a bit of a meltdown? In other words, Tom, you start to challenge your own self-talk. But as I said, in a gentle way, not in an aggressive way. Otherwise, you get in a bit of, you can provoke it, and then you can start adjusting. You can actually start changing your own language and start talking what I call progressive language, to actually change words that are negative or even ambiguous into stronger words that mean more to you. You know, words have different meanings to people. Words have power and energy. It's to challenge the monkey if, in fact, your own trump is more negative than you think's appropriate. And that's how you can start to tune your own brain. This is the tool number two, and it's called Mind the Monkey with an exclamation mark. And that's how you start to think more positively. You literally start challenging. You put the monkey on trial and saying, "Am I really that bad? Is he that much better than me? Is she that much? Am I that badly off? Is there nothing I can do about it?" And you just start to galvanize the troops. You start to connect the inner resources that you've still got that have got a bit lost. So that's tool number two.
Love it. I love it. These are great. And there's many more in this book, Don. And let's hold fire just in case people just think, well, I've listened to the podcast. I don't need to get the book now. It is a fascinating read, and it's a really helpful read. And, you know, taking on the monkey. And the reason the monkey works so much as a metaphor, a simian simile, is that not only is it chattering and it has energy, they're strong, these primal creatures inside us. They're physically strong. So this isn't something that's going to work overnight, is it? It takes time, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, this is the problem, isn't it? That whatever you say to people, they would love you to fix them. People want to be fixed, and me too. You know, we want to be happy immediately. We want the lockdown finished now. We don't want any negativity. We want to feel joyous and happy and be happy ever after and healthy. Of course we do. But some things, most things in life, I'm afraid, we have to make a bit of an effort. It's a kind of two-way deal. And we do have to get off our backsides and make some effort. And that's always the problem with books that say, I've read books that say, and here's 10 exercises that I want you to do, and make a note, put them in a book, write them all down. You think, oh, bloody hell, I haven't got time for that. Or you might start doing it, a bit like going to the gym and New Year's, you know.
Maybe
I should do that. Sounds like a good plan. But, you know, basically, I'm a lazy sod, and I think most of us do sort of do move a bit in that direction. And I don't like to have to do homework, as you know, from going back to school days again. I'd rather somebody fix me, but it isn't that simple. But I'm hoping, Tom, that I've cut through the psychobabble in the book, and it is simple in a way, and maybe fun, I hope, to actually use these brain tuning tools. My real goal is to teach people to be their own mind coaches, which, as I said earlier, is bad for business. But if I can teach one person to be their own mind coach, then that person can teach their kids or somebody else in their family that's struggling. The most wonderful thing I've heard is when somebody had said, oh, and a friend of mine or my sister, my brother, suddenly became very anxious about something. And I was able to teach him or her that some of the tools I learned to deal with their monkey. I explained the monkey concept to them, and they really liked it, and they're happy. That really, really did and does give me pleasure. If we can spread a sort of positive pandemic instead of these bloody viruses, and
absolutely.
And that's the way to do it. Teach people, show them how to. Don't just tell them what to do. Show them how to do it.
Yes, absolutely. Let's spread the virus of wisdom. Let's get that done.
Yeah.
Don McPherson, thank you so much for joining us on the Magic Book Club podcast. How to Master Your Monkey Mind, one of the few good things to come out of lockdown one, is available now. Don, thanks for joining
us. Thanks for having me.
There you go. That's all we've got time for this week on the Magic Book Club podcast. Join us next time for more of your favourite authors and stories. And in the meantime, happy reading.